Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning and welcome to the programme. Today, with the census telling us that Ireland is getting older, do we all now have to work later in life? France is banning short internal flights, but there's talk this week of the Cork to Dublin route here making a comeback. We'll debate what should happen. ITV bosses look likely to face questions from MPs in Westminster over their handling of allegations about presenter Philip Schofield, and we'll have plenty more too. 51551 for your text messages. You can email the programme todaycb@rte.ie. Minister for Health Stephen Donnelly, good morning.
Claire, thank you for having me in.
Thank you for coming into the studio. Now, Cabinet yesterday signed off on this ban on the sale of vapes or e-cigarettes to under 18s. How are you going to enforce that?
This is a child protection measure. So what we're doing is we will be banning the sale of vapes to anyone under the age of 18. And there's other things we're bringing in with it. So tobacco and vapes will be banned through self-service vending machines or mobile units, the type of things you see at events or you might see at festivals. They'll be banned. Critically, we're banning advertising on vapes as it pertains to children. So around schools, public transport, sports events that are primarily for children in cinemas, mm-hmm. and so forth. So it'll be policed in the same way that alcohol and tobacco and everything else is policed. The enforcement officers have significant powers. They can issue a fine on the spot for up to €2,000. And if there's an issue with that, they can proceed to court. And then there's very significant penalties that the courts can...
So are they going to be doing inspections themselves, or are they relying on members of the public to report breaches to them?
They'll do inspections. And indeed, they already do, because vapes they're a regulated product. And we've just seen some quite disturbing information from the UK in terms of unregulated vapes, which have all sorts of toxic substances, yep. in them, which are being vaporized and people are inhaling. So the HSE already inspects products and does visits. And what this will do now is give the enforcement officers significant additional powers to make sure that the shops are compliant with this legislation.
You'll know, though, when this was announced yesterday, the Irish Heart Foundation said it just doesn't go far enough, and they want a complete ban on flavours and disposable vapes, because they argue that we're going to see a generation lost again to smoking. Why didn't you do that? Because menthol cigarettes have been banned for a long time now. So the opportunity was there to lead out on this and ban, you know, the tutti frutti's and the bubblegum flavours and so on, pear drops. I mean, who are they aimed at?
Exactly. This is all aimed at children. I believe the combination of the very bright and colourful labelling, some of it anyway, and some of these flavours like bubblegum flavour, obviously that is aimed at children.
But you didn't ban those.
We are. So what we're doing is we have legislation domestically to ban for children, those under 18, and the various measures I just went through. What I'm doing now is working at an EU level to bring in not just an Irish ban, but an EU-wide restriction in terms of labelling and flavours. The EU is revising its tobacco directive to be published next year. And so what I'm going to be doing is working with them to bring it in. The advice I have from the department, which I think is correct, is it's more effective to do this right across the EU, have it in for next year. If the EU looks like it isn't going to go there, there will, as there always has been, intensive lobbying from the tobacco companies. And remember, it's the tobacco companies in a lot of cases that own these vaping products. We will move to legislate.
So did
here.
You look at banning those flavours and you found that it wasn't possible to do it without the EU?
It's not so much that it is impossible to do it without the EU. It's that the advice I have is that doing it on an EU level is more effective in terms of enforcement and making sure that just nowhere within the EU would there be, you know, the
but
the
that didn't apply to banning for under 18s.
No, exactly. So the directive from the EU next year won't be that. So the legislation we're bringing in covers the areas we want to cover now. And then we're going to move at an EU level on flavours and labelling. And as I said, we don't know where that EU directive is going to is going to land. Ireland is going to play a very strong role in it. We have good form on tobacco. We're recognised internationally on the smoking
ban.
Well,
that's the point, isn't it? Like, we did break new ground on the smoking ban, and we could have done that when it comes to those flavours, but we didn't take that opportunity.
No, I wouldn't agree with that. We broke new ground on the smoking ban. We actually broke new ground last week as well on alcohol labelling. I was in at the World Health Assembly in Geneva, and Ireland is the first country in the world now to bring in this comprehensive labelling on alcohol products, including direct links to cancer. All I'm saying is the advice from the department, which I agree with, is doing this at take the opportunity to do it right across the EU. And if it looks like the EU isn't going where we want to go, we'll just go there ourselves.
You mentioned alcohol, and we had Donal O'Shea in here during the week, and he was talking about how much we're consuming, but he highlighted a concern, and we've heard this from others too, about advertising companies plastering their zero alcohol branding around sporting events. You'll have seen this at all times of the day. That gets their brand out there. It avoids the bans, Donal O'Shea says. Do you agree with that? Do you think that measures need to be taken to stop that happening?
I do. And I've asked the department for exactly what legal routes are available under the existing legislation. And if it isn't possible under the existing legislation and regulations, I'm certainly very open to bringing in amending legislation. I think it's quite cynical. You know, I was at the Leinster match just a few weeks ago, and the shops you walked into had 0.0 everywhere. It was on the pitch. You know, and the whole point of the alcohol advertising bans was to decouple that link, particularly for kids. There's a lot of kids at those matches or watching those matches. My own kids were at home watching that match. I don't want my kids, and parents do not want their children, watching these brilliant sports events with alcohol advertising on the pitch. I believe, rightly or wrongly, I believe that it is a way of advertising that may be still compliant with the legislation, but is certainly not in the spirit, in my opinion, of the legislation.
So they're surreptitiously advertising their full alcohol brands.
Well, certainly what I can say is I don't think what's happening is acceptable. And I'm taking advice on what we do about it.
Yeah, they're getting away with it, though. You know, it's been happening for quite some time now. All of those billboards, as you say, the advertising that you spotted. It's happening. We're allowing it to happen. It wasn't spotted in advance of these brands becoming popular.
It has been spotted, but you know, I think it really has grown. You see it everywhere now. You know, it was on the pitch for the particular match. It was in the shops, the big cardboard cutouts. Then it's, you know, you see it around. My sense is it has grown. And
how quickly do you think you'll be able to move on this?
I want to see what the department comes back with. But certainly my view is that this is not within the spirit of what we're trying to do from a public health perspective.
Okay. Moving on then to overcrowding in our hospitals and the INMO. They said the Maybank holiday overcrowding at that point was out of control. The HSE CEO Bernard Gloucester has asked the HSE staff now to volunteer for extra work over this bank holiday weekend to avoid a dreadful position. Now, this was a fairly late request. Do you know, have you been given assurances that there will be enough staff in place to cope with what's expected in hospitals?
There need to be, because we saw this in the New Year bank holiday. We saw the two worst days we've had this year were the 2 days after the New Year bank holiday. And I convened a meeting of the HSE leadership and said, this is all hands on deck. You have to get people in and you have to run the service through the weekend. And what we saw was the number of patients on trolleys halved in about 6 days.
So it wasn't a dreadful position as the INMO said it was.
Sorry, which wasn't?
The bank holiday weekend.
Oh, it was. So what I'm saying is it happened at New Year's. It happened in some hospitals over the May bank holiday. I know there were hospitals on the May bank holiday where on the Tuesday there was an unacceptable number of patients waiting on trolleys. And the problem is, in the hospital, on the Saturday, the Sunday and the Monday, patients were not being discharged from wards. So what I want to see, we're in the middle, as you know, of the biggest expansion in healthcare capacity in many years, probably in many decades. But at the same time, Claire, doing that on its own isn't enough. We have to move to a hospital system and a health service that treats patients 7 days a week. And what we need to see is we need to see patients discharged at the weekends. The people working in our emergency departments are working flat out. In more and more hospitals, they're now in at the weekends running the services, places like Waterford, who have very few or no patients on trolleys. We need to see that rolled out. But critically, the solution to this is not in the emergency department. We need to see the community services and the hospital services working to provide services. Mm-hmm. As one doctor put it very simply to me earlier this week, he said, we run our hospital Monday to Friday. Our patients get sick Monday to Sunday.
Obviously, and that is something that will have been known for a time immemorial. Yeah. But the HSC CEO is saying, all I can say now is please to the staff to work. I mean, is that what you're saying at this point in time too?
He's starting there, and I think he's right to start there. When I called in the HSC after New Year, they put out a call. And they asked people to come in and do the right thing, and people responded. And we are blessed in this country with extraordinary healthcare professionals who want the best for their patients. You'll see in the new consultant contract, the whole point of the new consultant contract from the state's perspective is to expand normal working hours in the hospitals.
It's not 7 days either. I mean, is that a missed opportunity?
It's not 7 days, but it goes from standard rostered hours of 40 hours to 80 hours. So it doubles the amount of standard rostered hours. And of course, we know that nurses are rostered and junior doctors are rostered 24/7. If you or I walk into any hospital in Dublin at 3 a.m. this morning, we'll find junior doctors and we'll find nurses.
But you've just told us that the problem is with discharges and with consultants not being available over the weekend. And the new contract, this Great White Hope, doesn't roster them on Sundays.
It's not just consultants. Consultants are one part of this, but consultants can only discharge patients when they have access to radiology, when they have access to social workers, when they have access to physiotherapists, when they have access to discharge teams in the communities. So the point that Bernard Gloucester, the new chief exec, is making, and the point that I'm making is, this isn't about pointing at any one group within the health service and saying, we need you to work 7 days a week. This is about saying the end-to-end health service needs to move from largely 5 days a week. There are, of course, many people who work on Saturdays and Sundays, including consultants, to a 7 day service for patients.
Mm, it does sound pretty desperate, though, doesn't it? You're asking people who you concede are working really hard and doing the best they can, please do the right thing and work more over this weekend.
I don't think so. I think Bernard is doing the right thing. He's having a very mature conversation with highly dedicated and experienced healthcare professionals who want the best for their patients. Nurses are already scheduled at weekends, every weekend in hospitals. Junior doctors are, consultants will be through the new contract. And then health and social care professionals, they're going to need contractual changes, I think, probably through the upcoming pay talks.
Okay, and that's interesting. And is that something that you're already discussing with the Minister for Finance, Michael McGrath, that you're going to have to meet these pay demands in order to get this 7 day schedule up and running?
It's something that myself, the department and the HSC are working through first. So we need a very clear view as to the kind of additional flexibilities we want. But what I can tell you very clearly, Claire, is I spend a lot of time in hospitals and a lot of time in community care. And pretty much all of the healthcare workers I talk to agree that we have to move from 5 days to 7 days. They agree that we have to have better patient flow into the hospital, out of the hospital. One of the things we're doing is putting in place two urgent care plans, one for the rest of this year and then one for the next 3 years. And essentially, there are three pieces to it. Number one, what are the services we can provide so that people don't have to go into an emergency department? So GP out of hours, expanding primary care services, expanding GP access to diagnostics. Number two, what are the services within the hospital? And this comes to the treatment, mm-hmm. to radiology and to discharge. And then number three, we have to make sure that the discharge options are available for patients.
So you're saying to me that you're not yet convinced that the government is going to have to pay more to put this 7 day service in place. There might be other ways of slicing it.
I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying it wouldn't be helpful for me to start preempting public pay talks at this point. But what I can tell you is that there's already a wide variance across the hospitals. If you look at hospitals that are performing really well on their emergency departments, like Waterford, Tullamore, Portlaoise, and others, they already have mechanisms in place. They already have rosters
in place.
So this
is about how the hospital is run and how the management are performing.
It's partly about that. It's partly, this is the whole point. What we're doing is two things. We're expanding capacity at a level that hasn't been seen in a very long time, but that's not enough. The other thing we're doing is we are reforming and modernising how patients get that care. And moving to 7 days a week is one of those things. Moving to regional health areas, electronic health records, the new consultant contract, that's all part of a very important reform agenda that goes with the capacity.
You mentioned GPs as being possibly part of that solution. Now, I'm sure you're aware that people all over the country are having desperate problems trying to get in to see their GPs. Where is that going to be solved? How is it going to be solved?
It's going to be solved in a few different ways. One of the things we're doing is significantly increasing the number of college places. So Simon Harris and I...
Years away.
No.
Somebody who's trying to get an appointment today and is told, come back in a month.
Yeah, of course. So
bear with me.
I'm just giving you the full answer, right? So the first thing we're doing, when we've already started, is increase the number of GP college places. First thing. Next thing, which is much closer to now, is we're significantly increasing the number of GP training places. So that makes a big difference right away. These are qualified doctors in their training as GPs who are working with GPs and actively treating patients. Another thing we're doing is working with the Irish College of General Practitioners to bring in, between this year and next year, several hundred more GPs from around the world. There's another thing which we're doing as well. We're in negotiations, as you know, Claire, with the IMO at the moment to expand the GP cards to about another 400,000, 500,000 people. And I've provisioned in the budget a very substantial amount of money for the GPs to be able to invest in nursing. I'll give you one quick example. I met advanced practice nurses recently, in fact, very close to your own bailiwick in Bray, and they're treating 7 out of 10 patients who would normally go in to see a GP. So yes, we need more GPs, but actually what we're going to be doing is investing in nursing and investing in advanced practice in general practice as well.
Yeah, but you did promise that free GP care for the 6 and 7 year olds in the last budget. That hasn't happened yet. I mean, is it fair to do that to people, to say this is coming and then it doesn't happen?
There's been a lot of resistance to it. We are focusing at the moment on expanding up to the median income. So this will mean that for the first time, over half the population will have access to fully state-funded GP care, either through a medical card or a GP card. The GPs are nervous, and I understand their nervousness.
They would say they're overworked and they're underpaid.
Well, they're certainly not underpaid. They've done a great job, and they have been well paid over the last number of years to do that work, and they've done an excellent job. They're nervous. They're saying we need more GPs. They're right. They're saying if we're going to add 500,000 more people to state-funded GP care, we need more capacity. And that's exactly what the tens of millions we've put on the table is for. Investment in GP practices, investment in practice nurses, investment in advanced practice, expanding the capacity of GPs around the country.
The Children's Hospital, how much is it going to cost?
The current provision is 1.4 billion, and we've known for years, we knew long before this government came in, that it was going to be significantly more than that. The Hospital Development Board is working very closely with BAM. I expect BAM to fulfil their contractual obligations and have this hospital handed over next year as agreed. There are significant disputes in terms of additional amounts of money. And there's a dispute resolution mechanism in place, which the Development Board is working with BAM on. At the moment, it would be in nobody's interests, for me or anyone in government, to say, we expect the final additional bill to be X, because that would prejudice. There's nothing that the contractor would like
but more than to hear that number. You know where the figure is going to land.
We don't know accurately. There is an independent dispute resolution mechanism in place. And then if either party isn't happy with that, they can escalate it to the High Court, which they've done previously.
You know what the ask is from the developer at this stage?
The ask is several hundred million. Yeah. But we can't prejudice the independent dispute resolution mechanism or indeed the courts who may end up ruling on some of this.
People expect it's going to be over 2 billion and there are those who say it'll be closer to 3 billion.
No, it won't be closer to 3 billion.
But it'll be over 2.
No, you see, I can't get into this. We can't get into a conversation. We cannot prejudice this. The Development Board has an important job, which is to get this hospital delivered according to the contract. There's a dispute resolution mechanism in place and we have to leave those mechanisms do what they want to do. And Claire, I understand members of the Oireachtas and you and your listeners are saying, what's the likely amount? So I understand the question. It's a very reasonable question.
It's taxpayers' money.
Of course. But in order to protect taxpayers' money, we need to get the best possible outcome for the state.
And do you understand how our colleagues in Europe can build state-of-the-art hospitals for a fraction of this cost? I mean, we hear about half of what we're expected to pay, in some cases a third of what we're expected to pay.
Yes, I was one of the leading voices giving out at the time about the cost escalation on this. I don't think this was set up properly. I don't think it was contracted properly. And I think that's partly responsible for some of the overruns that we're seeing. What we're doing now is looking at less expensive building methods. So, for example, you'll be aware that I'm seeking government agreement on an extra 1,500 hospital beds. Critically, we want them to be modular build, rapid build technologies, which the initial estimates would suggest come in at about half the price of traditional build. So if we're going to increase capacity at the level we have to, we need more beds. We've already delivered a record amount, but we need a lot more. If we're going to do that and do it in a way that is value for money, we've got to be looking at this sort of these sort of new approaches.
So we're not getting value for money on the Children's Hospital. That's the conclusion you've reached, the logical conclusion from what you've just said.
What I'm saying is, and I've been on the record many times on this, I don't believe this was set up in the right way. And I think as a result of that, the final price will be more than it needed to be. However, I can say I've been in the Children's Hospital several times. It is going to be an absolute game changer for healthcare provision, hospital care provision for children in this country. It is an extraordinary facility.
Now, later on in the programme, we're going to be hearing from a woman who has terminal cancer. Now, she's seeking a drug called Trodelvy from the HSE. She doesn't have insurance. This woman is using the drug, and she'll explain this, to not to save her life, but to extend the time that she has left. Now, she knows there's a review underway, but she fears basically that she's going to die before that review is completed. Do you have an update for her on that drug, Trodelvy?
No, I'm getting one. Getting one at the moment. We only just got the name of it before coming on air. So I'll certainly, we'll have that for you later on. We've asked the department of the HSE for that.
Just a wider issue, though, of these high-tech and expensive drugs. This is going to be coming down the tracks more and more. How is the state going to deal with this?
There's a few things we're doing. The first thing is we have very significantly increased our drugs budget. So we've gone, over the last 10 years, the drugs budget has gone from, it's doubled. It's gone from 1.3 billion to 2.6 billion. So there's been a huge increase. In my three budgets, we've added 100 million in terms of new drugs. In the term of this government, that 100 million, about a third of the money goes to cancer drugs. That 100 million that we've sanctioned so far, 127 drugs have been approved and 50 of those have been cancer drugs.
And are you happy with the pace of the assessments and how they are carried out when a new drug, which could change somebody's life, save somebody's life, are you happy with how that system is being run?
Not in all cases, no. So there was a report done by a company called Mazars. We published that earlier this year. And I made it very clear to the HSE that I wanted to see a more transparent process. The process works well sometimes. So you'll be aware with the CF drugs. Remember, there were these 35 kids who were excluded from Kaftrio in a manner which I think was fundamentally wrong by the drugs company. The HSE moved on that quickly. It was assessed quickly and all 35 of those children now have access to Kaftrio. So sometimes it works very well. The biggest complaint I hear, which I agree with, is that people like the lady you're going to be talking to later on, they want to know where this is in the process. They want to know exactly what the criteria are. And that's one of the things that I've said to the HSE we need to change. We need more transparency so people can at a minimum, they can know where it is. But can I say, Claire, we can do anything we want with the process, but ultimately what you have to have is you have to have the money to buy the drugs. And that's why we've doubled the drugs budget. And if you look at the portion of that that is for these so-called high-tech drugs or high-cost drugs, that's gone from 400 million to 800 million. Mm-hmm. So we're spending a lot of money. But for the lady you're going to be talking to, that's all well and good. She just needs access to the drug as quickly as possible.
And you've sought answers on that, and hopefully you'll be able to supply them. Now, again, on spending, we've had a number of bariatric surgeons on the programme, and they tell us that they're spending more time and more money fixing botched surgeries that are done overseas in places like Turkey than actually carrying out surgeries here themselves. What are you doing about that? How are you going to address that?
So we've some really good news on this. I met Donal O'Shea. I had a meeting with him last year. And himself and a colleague put forward to me a very compelling case for an entirely new bariatrics service. And they talked about exactly this. Patients going to Turkey, they couldn't get access here, complications arising, and Professor O'Shea and his colleagues trying to help patients in an awful lot of difficulty. So Donal put forward a very large ask, several million recurrent funding. He assured me that he had people he could hire all over the country ready to go. So I authorised the full ask through the budget. That's now in place. And I have to say, huge respect to Donal O'Shea. He made some big claims around the number of people he was going to be able to hire and get these services moving. And so I took a leap of faith that he could. And I have to say, Claire, they are hiring and they are now rolling these services out around the country, and it's going to make a big difference.
Do you think that will put an end, though, to those travelling roadshows from those clinics in places like Turkey, as I mentioned, in hotels and different places, asking people to tick a few boxes, pay $3,000, go over there, stay in a hotel, get picked up from the airport, have bariatric surgery and come home?
I hope it does. We need to help people here in Ireland, and bariatric surgery is an important part of that. If I could just say one thing that really struck me in the meeting I had with Donal and his colleagues, he said, you know, people misunderstand obesity and they misunderstand bariatrics, and there's this kind of somewhat lazy response of, would you not just change your calorie intake and would you not just get in your steps and
all of this? It's a disease, and we know that.
Donal made the point, he said, it's like telling someone who has skin cancer that they need to put on sun cream. You know, you have to be able to treat what has happened. Okay. And can I just congratulate Donal and all of his team on what they're doing. We're putting in place now a service that Ireland will be very proud of.
Okay, now, the chair of an independent review into Ireland's abortion laws is going to tell the Joint Oireachtas Committee on Health later today that the provisions of the legislation should be changed. And this includes the removal of the mandatory 3-day waiting period. What is your stance on that? Will you do that?
I have a personal view, Claire, and what I've said to your colleagues on the radio previously is, as Minister for Health, I've referred this to the Health Committee. Their first hearing is today, or one of their hearings is today. And I want to leave them get on with their work, and I don't want to be seen to be prejudicing their work. What I will say is the work that Marie O'Shea has done is very important. It's very useful work. It breaks into a lot of operational recommendations and a fairly small number of legislative recommendations. We've set up a group now within the HSC to progress the operational recommendations, and obviously the Health Committee and the Oireachtas and government will consider the legislative proposals. Regardless of what comes out of that, though, I want to be very clear, my focus is on expanding access. Only 11 of the 19 maternity services in the country provide termination services. By the end of the year, that'll have gone from 11 to 17, and it'll be all 19 next year. And the second thing we're doing is we're putting in place protections for clinicians and for women availing of the services. You know, we're legislating for safe access zones. And one of the things that I hope we are going to see now is we already have in excess of 420 GPs around the country. I hope we will see more GPs signing up now as well.
Because Marie O'Shea, who you mentioned, she's called for strong leadership and courage from government on this. But you're saying, I'll let the process play out. I mean, surely this is the time to direct what should happen, particularly in relation to the 3-day waiting period.
On the operational recommendations, that's exactly what we're doing. So if we're going from 11 hospitals up to all 19 hospitals, we're legislating for safe access zones. We're fully funding the clinicians around the country to do what needs to be done. So that's the kind of leadership we need to see in place. When it comes to the legislative proposals, what I'm saying is I want to respect the Oireachtas, I want to respect the Health Committee, and I want to give them the space they need, and then we'll see where we go with that.
Minister, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for coming in. Minister for Health, Claire. Stephen Donnelly.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.